I said to my wife, one thing you know about Stalin. And her immediate response was, oh, well, he killed 30 million people. And I've seen figures as high as 60 million people bandied about. Sure. I think Robert Conquest had it at 20 million people. Yes. So my question to you is, what is the real number and what embellishments have been made by mainstream historians over the years?
Okay, well, just one word about Stalin. Stalin was not a dictator. But in any case, Stalin was not a dictator. That's part of the anti-Stalin paradigm. Okay, you can't say that. All right. It's not considered appropriate to say that. Okay, and you've asked another interesting question. Is how many people did Stalin kill? And I think the answer is zero. Stalin didn't kill anybody.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome. I have a special guest today, Professor Grover Fuhr, who's written many books concentrating on the Stalin era in Soviet history. And just as I was saying before we came on air, I made a video a couple of weeks back that has already had over 90,000 views. It was called, What If Everything You Know About Stalin Is a Lie? And I've been kind of interested in how kind of much interest there is in this topic, and two, how relatively open-minded most of the comments were. I was expecting a huge kind of backlash. There were comments from people all around the world saying, yeah, parts of this story don't add up. So I might as well ask my first question, which is, you have coined the term anti-Stalin paradigm to describe the way in which most mainstream history of the Soviet Union is done. Can you explain what this anti-Stalin paradigm is and how it came about?
Yes, that's a great question. I think it's important to start with the Russian Revolution. There was scholarship, of course, in the West and on Russia before the revolution, but once the revolution took place, the scholarship in the West that began basically was focused or became focused on anti-communist propaganda, sort of providing fuel, providing information for the anti-communist political tendencies, directions of Western capitalist countries and their rulers. And that has remained the main focus of what you might call Russian history, Soviet history, ever since. There are certain periods when it kind of seems to ebb and flow, but the primary function in academia, as well as, you know, outside academia, of Soviet historiography has been to provide ammunition, negative stories that can function as propaganda for the anti-communist politics of Western capitalist imperialist countries. And that remains the case today. Surprisingly, I guess to some people, initially it was to me, it remains just as strong here more than 30 years after the end of the Soviet Union than it was during the Soviet period itself. And of course, after Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev's famous or infamous secret speech attacking Stalin at the 20th Party Congress in February 1956, the anti-Stalin paradigm becomes the mainstream and really the only tolerated viewpoint within the Khrushchev and post-Khrushchev Soviet Union too. So it's a very, very powerful current, has been for generations now. And what it means is that all research on the Stalin period, which we might define as from the late 20s to Stalin's death in 1953, all research has to fit what might be called the Procrustean bed of anti-Stalin tendency. Okay, it has to be fitted into a very hostile framework, and it doesn't mean that some good historiography doesn't go on, but that historiography has to be framed in a very anti-Stalin manner. And without that kind of framing, you're just not going to get published if you're in that field.
Yeah, and I remember you said in one of the talks of yours that I've seen at some point that it's a little bit like when Galileo was doing research after Copernicus. Right. Do you want to explain that analogy a little bit?
I guess I did say that once or twice. Upon reflection, I think it's immodest, to put it mildly, to compare myself to Galileo. So I try to everybody forget that particular analogy, but there's some validity in it, which means that Galileo's issue was the evidence, right? He pointed his telescope at the moons of Jupiter or something along those lines and saw that they went around Jupiter and hypothesized that maybe Copernicus had been right a century before. The evidence appeared to demolish the geocentric theory of the universe. And all of the authorities in his day said, you can't do that. You can't question the Bible. You can't question the authorities, whether Protestant or Catholic, in all these countries. You can't do it, and we're going to punish you horribly if you do it. And so he backed off. But of course, he made the famous, supposedly made the famous statement, well, but that's the way it is anyway, right? No matter what I say, no matter what you say, that's reality. So what I try to focus on is primary source evidence. And the evidence demolishes the horror stories about Stalin and the Stalin period.
Right. And conversely, if you go into something with a preconceived notion that Stalin was a monster, as an example, you're going to kind of find evidence to confirm that pre-existing bias, or you're going to see things that aren't there, for example. Yeah.
Okay. Or I have been in touch with a number of Soviet scholars of the Soviet Union who are, more or less in the mainstream, but are honest people. And two of them over the years have told me that I should put some anti-Stalin stuff into my books because they will not be accepted. They will not be be credible unless I do that. And of course, I have not done that. But I have the luxury of not being in the field of professional Soviet history. Okay, I am a professor of English, of medieval literature. And so I don't have to worry about being excluded from mainstream journals and publications, not being invited to conferences, and all of these things that someone in the professional field of Soviet studies would need to be very careful about, because that's how you maintain your job and your career in that field. So if you want to be in that field and you want to have a career, you simply have to toe the line, so to speak. I'm in a very different and more favorable position. Also, I don't aim my research at the scholars in the field of professional Soviet studies. I'm not really writing for them. That doesn't mean that none of them ever read it, but that's not my primary audience. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to worry about stuff like that.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, one of the things, just as I was preparing to, do this interview, I was wondering, has anybody kind of reviewed your books, from the field? I found one incredibly hostile review, which was full of name calling and ad hominems and things. And there was one part where this person, I think it was a French author, quoted Stalin. And learning from you, I immediately went to the speech that they quoted from and saw, hold on, a whole section of this speech that you've omitted, which gives a different set of dates. So they weren't even talking about the right incident. And the whole part where Stalin says, yeah, all of these things went too far and we've stopped them. It said the complete opposite of what the person who was supposedly refuting you said. And I just thought, that's really interesting. But most people just won't bother to do that basic bit of one bit of source checking where you could immediately see that the person has dishonestly framed something. Anyway, I'll ask my second question here, which is my understanding of the basic overarching thesis across all of your books is that the ultimate sources of the anti-Stalin paradigm are, and this is where it gets a bit tricky because you're kind of following a trail, really. First, you have the diatribes against Stalin written by Trotsky in the 1930s while he was in Mexico and elsewhere, which are almost all lies. And you wrote a big, thick book on that, which was later turned into three books, as I understand it. Second is the repetition of those lies with further embellishments by Khrushchev in the secret speech of 1956. Third, there is then the historians and other professional ideologists under Khrushchev who repeated what he said in the speech and then added further details to the claim. Fourth is the work of Robert Conquest, who's a famous historian of the 60s, 70s, a kind of Cold Warrior, who uncritically copied almost all of those claims. And finally, there are Western mainstream historians working after Conquest, who then repeat his claims during the Cold War era, which then get passed uncritically down into modern scholarship, and there's almost like a kind of lattice of these footnotes of people quoting each other. Does this accurately describe the process? And why do you think these different groups of people built this edifice of lies about Stalin? And I ask that question because, the neutral observer may say, well, some of these people were kind of against each other too. For example, the Cold Warriors were against Khrushchev, who never rehabilitated Trotsky or allowed Trotskyites back into the Communist Party. So how do you, why are all these different people making up lies about Stalin?
Sure. Well, I think you have a good outline there of the, what you might call the various stages or even generations of the anti-Stalin paradigm, anti-Stalin propaganda. Yeah, you've omitted one very important stage, and that is the period of Mikhail Gorbachev, the last chairman of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, who came to his position in 1985 and remained until 1991. And Gorbachev's campaign against Stalin was at least as vigorous and as negative as that of Khrushchev. Gorbachev picked up a lot of the Khrushchev-era falsifications, and then his people working under him, historians and others, multiplied them and invented new falsehoods. So The Gorbachev stage is very important too. I just want to mention very briefly that after the end of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev and his what you might call his right-hand man, Alexander Yakovlev, who was a close associate of Gorbachev's and whom Gorbachev promoted to be the in charge of propaganda in the Soviet Communist Party. Gorbachev and Yakovlev admitted that they had a kind of conspiracy to get rid of Soviet socialism, to demolish the Soviet Union, and that they would start as Khrushchev had started, by attacking Stalin, but then go on to attack other figures like Lenin and even Marx and Engels. But the Soviet Union came to an end, and Soviet socialism was put to the sword before it got to that stage. So, but that having been said, if you insert the Gorbachev period into your chronology, I think that's correct. And I've already dealt with very briefly the generation of the anti-Stalin paradigm and the need to foment anti-communist propaganda, beginning virtually with the Russian Revolution itself. Trotsky, well, briefly put, Trotsky wanted to be the leader of the Soviet Union. It's well known that there was an ideological struggle in the 1920s, which Trotsky and his supporters did not win. They lost. In 1921, Lenin was still alive. The 10th Party Congress of the Communist Party passed a resolution against factionalism, that you couldn't have a faction promoting its own political line within the Communist Party, that was in contradiction to democratic centralism. Once the line had been established at a party conference or party congress, then everybody had to put that forward. Trotsky repeatedly, and his followers, repeatedly violated this. Ultimately, Trotsky was expelled, and he spent the rest of his life doing a number of things, but always vilifying Stalin as strongly as he possibly could. So he had his own motives. Now, in one of your questions, you ask, why did Khrushchev attack Stalin the way he did? And of course, Khrushchev never told us. It was Khrushchev's accusations against Stalin were accepted in the Soviet Union because of the influence of the Communist Party, which repeated them and which made them really obligatory, textbooks and historical writing. And of course, it was gratefully accepted in the anti-communist capitalist countries. I mean, why look a gift horse in the mouth? Here's Khrushchev attacking Stalin and making the communist movement under Stalin look terrible. Why not just go with that? That's really what Conquest and many, many others did. They just accepted that Khrushchev must be telling the truth. The Trotskyists, likewise, many of the accusations of crimes that Khrushchev and then his acolytes, his men set forward were either the same as or similar to the accusations that Trotsky had made. And so an attack on Stalin tended, whether Khrushchev intended it or not, tended to rehabilitate Trotsky, to a large extent. And so the Trotskyist movement, which by the middle 1950s was small and getting smaller all the time, received a tremendous shot in the arm and exploded, not only in Europe, but the United States, all over the world. And the Trotskyist movement continues to repeat anti-communist falsehoods about Stalin because they sustain the Trotsky cult. Now, I haven't dealt with Brezhnev. I know you have another question coming up about him. But when it comes to Gorbachev and Gorbachev's right-hand men, so to speak, it seems clear to me that they believed what Khrushchev had said. And they drew certain logical conclusions from it, namely that the whole notion of building a socialist society, the whole notion of having a socialist revolution, relying on the working class and so forth, must be poisoned at the root, okay? It had to be illegitimate, leading something that could lead only to criminal consequences, and therefore had to be destroyed. And that was the conclusion that Gorbachev and Yakovlev and others drew, and they, after the end of the Soviet Union, admitted it. And of course, they could not admit that while the Soviet Union still existed, while Gorbachev was working his way up the party ranks, and even after he became party chairman. As Gorbachev and Yakovlev both said, they had to pretend to be good Leninists while the Soviet Union was still in existence. So they concentrated their fire on falsifying Soviet history during the Stalin period. But I believe that that they believed that they themselves credited Khrushchev's lies and the lies of the Khrushchev era about Stalin. And that leads to a further question, which is why did Khrushchev do what he did? And I believe you have another question about that, but the short answer is we really are not sure.
Yeah, well, before we get back onto Khrushchev, sure. The right wing or conservative,
sure,
cold warriors,
yes,
what are today called neocons or neoconservatives, are known to have been former Trotskyists. I mean, James Burnham famously, yeah, Irving Kristol. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. You know, the line they told people is that they were mugged by reality. And now, miraculously, yeah, Trotskyists have become conservatives. But do you think it's actually significant that these men who were, you know, in basically the bulwark of American anti-communism, were actually Trotskyists? So, like, in a strange way, America or the American popular imagination gets the Trotsky narrative,
yeah,
of what happened. Is that significant, do you think?
Well, sure. You know, when you have a figure who is famous for being one of the most prominent Bolshevik leaders during the period of the October Revolution in 1917, and then during the period of the Civil War, Trotsky was the commissar of the Army and the Navy, you know, in the Politburo, in the leading group of the Communist Party for a number of years after the Civil War. When somebody like that starts to accuse the leader of the Soviet Union, Stalin, of all kinds of terrible crimes and acts of dishonesty and perfidy and so forth, But this is bound to appeal to ideological anti-communists. And ideological anti-communism, of course, is very powerful in Western countries, including the United States and other Western societies. And so the pressure on people who are attracted to the communist movement, who avow the goals of the communist movement, the pressure on them to improve their careers, you know, their living conditions, their careers, to abjure all of that is very great. And some people did. And so Trotskyism can be regarded as a kind of, a halfway house, right? You're a communist. And then, you know, well, Trotsky criticizes Stalin. So now you sidle up to the Trotskyist and to Trotsky. And now you're a critical communist, you know. And then at a certain point, that becomes too much and you become a champion of capitalism. So that, I think, the general trajectory of Trotskyism. That is to say, they believed Trotsky. One of the books that I wrote some years ago now that you alluded to a few minutes ago, it was called Trotsky's Amalgams. And the genesis of that book was, you know, I wrote a book about Khrushchev's secret speech and discovering by analyzing, studying and analyzing the primary source documents that have come out of the Soviet archives since the end of the Soviet Union, and discovered that Khrushchev lied. That's the name of the book. And, immediately it occurred to me, well, at some point I'm going to have to do something about Trotsky, because Trotsky basically said very similar things, in a few cases, even the same thing. So if Khrushchev lied, that implies, no doubt, that Trotsky lied too, but you can't just leave it at that. You've got to go look for the evidence. So I looked at the evidence and found that that Trotsky lied to an extent that's hard to believe until you looked carefully into it. He just lied all the time. And so since that book, I've written four now other books about Trotsky. Because Trotskyists sound like revolutionaries, like strong anti-capitalist forces. But when it comes to Trotsky, they don't do effort. They just accept not only whatever Trotsky said, which of course is an error right there, right? You should never accept what some authority says. You should never accept what Khrushchev said. You should never accept what Grover Fur says. Okay? But not only do Trotskyists accept that, but they accept any and all anti-Stalin accusations that come from overtly anti-communist, pro-capitalist writers as well. So Trotskyism has sort of devolved into an organization that critiques that attacks Stalin and the Stalin period while claiming to be the true communists. And that, I think, appeals to those people who are attracted, to some people who are attracted to the goals of communism and socialism, but have been made a little gun shy, maybe, by all of the anti-Stalin propaganda.
So just to briefly come back on Khrushchev, I mean, one of the things that is very striking about the secret speech is the enormous PR damage it did to the USSR. Okay. I mean, it kind of killed, I mean, in the West, people who were committed Marxists and so on felt the need to disavow it or to apologize for ever having and supported the Soviet Union. So given that he was the leader of the USSR, why, like, what was he thinking? Why did he do this?
Well, I mean, we don't, he wrote memoirs, but he insisted in his memoirs, often in a very contradictory way, that, you know, that what he said about Stalin was true, that he, you know, doubled down on all of his lies and even invented lies and even invented some more. So we don't really know. It's not like Khrushchev admitted, hey, I lied and here's why I lied. If you look at Khrushchev's policies, the ones he's most famous for, and I've not done any special research on this, but if you look at those policies, I think that it's clear that Khrushchev had sharp disagreements with the policies that Stalin stood for. Certainly with the notion of violent revolution in capitalist countries in order to bring about socialism. He didn't agree with that. Khrushchev became famous for his position of a peaceful coexistence, and somehow or other overcoming capitalism in a peaceful manner. I think that was his main issue. And I think that Khrushchev saw socialism as essentially a mechanism for industrialization and modernization. That is, he had an economic determinist notion of socialism, which was, by the way, it wasn't just him. Lots of people, particularly perhaps in the colonial and former colonial countries, where the urge for modernization and to build a strong society economically, politically, militarily was very powerful urge. Many people in the World Communist Movement and others who were around the World Communist Movement had a similar idea that communism was perhaps the best tool around to build a strong national state. And that, of course, is not the same as viewing communism as the way of building a classless society that is based upon the power of working people. So without going into details about other disagreements that Khrushchev had with the policies identified with Stalin, I think that, that's a kind of first order approximation of Khrushchev's disagreements. But clearly Khrushchev could not have been the only person in the Soviet leadership to have these ideas, or his secret speech would not have gone down. He would probably never have made it. Most of the delegates to the 20th Party Congress in 1956 who heard Khrushchev's secret speech had to have known that at least some of what Khrushchev said about Stalin was false. But they did not rebel against it. They didn't question it. Now, in the few years, in the next 6 or 7 or 8 years after Khrushchev's secret speech, the Chinese Communist Party, when it was led by Mao Zedong, did question it. It did question Khrushchev's policies. But they did not have the evidence that we have now. They did not know when they criticized Khrushchev as a phony communist, for example. It was the name of one of the essays in the so-called Sino-Soviet dispute of the late 50s and early 60s. They did not know, they could not know, that Khrushchev had simply lied. They didn't have the evidence. They didn't have the documentation that we now have, thanks to the Soviet Union having come to an end. But they did see that the general tendency of Khrushchev's attack on Stalin was as a kind of cover of abandoning the the struggle for socialist revolution.
Just before we move off Khrushchev, do you think that his Ukrainian background is of any relevance to any of his actions?
No, I don't. I don't think that's... I haven't run across anything that would lead me to that conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but Khrushchev was actually involved himself in many of the... of implementing many of the things that he accused Stalin of, right?
Sure. Khrushchev was promoted to the Politburo in early 1938. I don't want to say...
Right.
I'm not sure which month, but he was promoted to the Politburo in early 1938. And before that, he had been the first secretary of the party in Moscow, which obviously was an extremely important position. And mm-hmm. after that, he was first secretary in Ukraine, which is another very important territory of the Soviet Union. So Khrushchev was a significant party leader during the 1930s and during Stalin's lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so Stalin must have had some confidence in him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So whatever process it was that produced Khrushchev had to have been functioning, had to have been in operation at least during the 1930s, if not even earlier.
Now, one of the most interesting aspects of your work is the time and space that you give to seriously considering the charges made in the Moscow trials. In fact, you have a whole book on this. Now, these are usually dismissed, and I have to admit, before I read your book, this was my view too. You know, I was just remember being taught in school, well, these were show trials. These were just nonsense, you know. Can you explain what exactly the defendants were accused of at the Moscow trials?
Sure.
And why mainstream historians typically just dismiss these charges? Mm-hmm. And what would it mean to Soviet history if it could be shown that the men were guilty?
Sure. Well, of course, the trials were part of the uncovering and exposure of the underground, that is, the clandestine conspiracy by Trotsky and his supporters. Trotsky, of course, is outside the country, but he has prominent supporters within the Soviet Union, and also what were called the Rights, that is, people like Bukharin, Nikolai Bukharin, Alexei Rykov, and others who were opposed to crash industrialization, crash enforced collectivization of agriculture, who opposed those policies. Before I go on to say some critical things about the defendants in the Moscow trials and the clandestine conspiratorial groups within the Soviet Union, let me just say that from the get-go, from the end of the Civil War, if not before, but certainly from the end of the Russian Civil War in 1921 or so, when it became clear that the Soviet Union was going to survive, was not going to be crushed by either the Tsarist forces, the White Armies, or by the Western imperialist powers who had intervened in a kind of half-hearted way to try to crush the Soviet, the Russian Revolution, it became clear that the Soviet Union was going to survive. A strong tendency in the Bolshevik Party had always been, in fact, in all Marxist groups, had always been to believe that socialism was going to come in an advanced industrial society, something like England, France, Germany, an advanced industrial society. And here, socialism had been won in a society like Russia, the Soviet Union, which had some very important industrial centers, unquestionably, but which was at least 80% poor peasants working under virtually medieval conditions, really a feudal polity. So there were some abortive attempts at revolution after the First World War. They were all defeated. And then the question came, can the Soviet Union survive? Because it appeared that one way of reading Marxism was that the Soviet Union would not be able to survive without the support of a socialist revolution in one or more advanced industrial societies. Now, to say that, which is one reading of the Marxism of the early 20th century, and no question about it. You could read it that way, and many people did. But to say that is very disillusioning. I mean, what's the road to the future? There is no road to the future for the Soviet Union, right? It can't persist. And that was a strong tendency in the Bolshevik Party. I've mentioned the Reichs, I've mentioned Trotsky. Stalin and others developed a different projection of the future, which was something like this. Well, the capitalists did not complete their historical purpose in Russia. They did not industrialize the country. They did not create an advanced industrial society with a large working class. Therefore, we have to do it. We have to do it, and we can do it. We, meaning the Soviet people under the proper leadership in the Communist Party. And so that debate essentially characterizes the economic aspect of the political debates of the 1920s. It's not surprising that the perspective that socialism can be built in one country, which is associated with Stalin, rightly so. It's not surprising that won out because, I mean, what did all of these Bolsheviks, what did all these communists make the revolution for? That's what they made it for. So that was the position that won out. Now I'm leaving personalities and, the kinds of quarrels that took place and the party conferences and party congresses during the 1920s, leaving all that aside. But that's the basic situation. Now, let's suppose that you are not a follower of Stalin, the Stalin line that says, yes, we can build a powerful socialist state by our own efforts, by crash industrialization, by collectivizing agriculture. Let's suppose you are one of those who has a more traditional view in some ways of Marxism that says that cannot be done. And therefore, one way of thinking is that to pursue the policies associated with Stalin is going to doom socialism not only in the Soviet Union, but also perhaps in the world communist movement. And that becomes more important than anything, more important than democratic centralism, more important than, whatever it is Lenin may have said, and certainly more important than anything that Stalin has to say. That justifies plotting against the party leadership, that justifies clandestine conspiracies to get rid of the Soviet regime, led by Stalin, that justifies collaboration with the foreign capitalists who also want to get rid of Stalin and Soviet socialism. That justifies, that goal justifies stepping backwards, backtracking, maybe inviting the capitalists to come back, maybe actually building capitalism within the Soviet Union, so that at some point in the distant future, when the Soviet Union has industrialized along the lines of Western capitalist societies, maybe then there could be a revolution that meets the traditional Marxist requirements. So I think that the conspiracies and the crimes of the Trotskyist and rightist and other conspirators in the 20s and particularly the 30s in the Soviet Union were motivated by those kinds of goals. Okay, they weren't evil people as such. They simply thought that the Stalin program would be a disaster for the socialist movement within the Soviet Union and worldwide. Now, during the 30s, briefly, these conspiracies, which nobody disagrees with, I mean, we have so much evidence that they really existed that you'd have to be, well, no serious student says that there were none. These conspiracies continued. In 1934, in December 1934, the first secretary of the Leningrad Communist Party, Sergei Kirov, was assassinated. And the assassin who was tried to commit suicide but failed, named other conspirators with whom he was associated, with whom he would have organized. And those people were connected to some of these former party leaders who had been rightists, Grigory Zinoviev, Lev Kamenev, and eventually evidence was obtained to indict them, and that was the first Moscow trial. That led to the first Moscow trial in 1936, the first so-called show trial, August 1936. And the investigations, arrests and interrogations, investigations continued and led to the second Moscow trial, the so-called Trotskyist trial of January 1937, and then the third Moscow trial in March 1938 of the rightists, Bukharin, Rykov, and others, and Trotskyists. So now, today, after the end of the Soviet Union, we have hundreds of confessions, interrogations, statements that were made by conspirators to the investigators. We have a tremendous amount of evidence that shows that these people were, in fact, guilty. But in the 1930s, in fact, up until the end of the Soviet Union, we didn't have this evidence. Okay, it was not available. It was secreted away in Soviet archives that no one could see except a small number of trusted archivists and historians. And so it was easy to claim by anti-communists, by Trotskyists, of course, by supporters of the rights, that these people had been forced in some way or other to confess. There was never any evidence that they had been forced to confess. In fact, there's lots of evidence that they were not. But there's one more thing. Just let me mention this. The transcript of the 1936 trial is actually quite short. It's abbreviated. When it was published in an abbreviated form. The outcry from the Trotskyists and the anti-communists and the social democrats was, you know, this is no good. We don't accept this. The transcript of the January 1937 trial is 600 pages long. The transcript of the March 1938 Moscow trial is 800 pages long. And these are abbreviated transcripts, but they're still, there's an awful lot of it. Very few people bother to read, to study those transcripts. If you do, the evidence is very convincing. There has never been any evidence that the confessions given by the people in these trials were coerced, and there's plenty of evidence that they could not possibly have been coerced. Let me give you one example. In the 1938 trial, the trial of the Wrights and Trotskyites, March 1938, Nikolai Bukharin, very prominent Bolshevik, very prominent conspirator, confessed to certain crimes that he was accused of, but he spent most of his testimony denying in the strongest possible language some of the most significant accusations that the prosecution made against him. Now, if he were fearful of torture, if he had been fearful that his family would be persecuted, he would never have done that. You know, he would just simply never have fought tooth and nail against the prosecutor, Vyshinsky, to deny some of the major charges that Vyshinsky brought against him. And in his final statement at the trial, Bukharin said, well, people are going to wonder why I'm confessing. And the first thing he says is, obviously, the evidence against me played a very major role. So a careful reading of the texts of these Moscow trials, I think, dispels any suspicion that you might have that these people were coerced. But as I've said, we now have hundreds of documents of testimony in the case of all of these trials against all of these people and against many others. We have the evidence now. There's an awful lot more evidence that's still in the archives because nobody is looking for it, but we have a tremendous amount of evidence. Now, as for why people believed that they were fraudulent, I think Khrushchev had a lot to do with that. Trotsky clearly said it's all fake. And then Khrushchev picked that up, and it fit the anti-Stalin paradigm very well. It was very convenient to the anti-communist scholarly world to simply accept what Khrushchev said. In fact, a number of the scholars of Soviet history of the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s would make statements like, well, for what happened next, we can turn to Nikita Khrushchev's secret speech. As though that were somehow or other primary source evidence for anything. Well, of course, we know that it wasn't. But it should have been obvious from the get-go that Khrushchev and his historians, and then Gorbachev and his historians, had no evidence. They could not cite any evidence.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I found quite convincing is you actually showed a few examples of where defendants had actually lied in the testimony, i.e. they said they hadn't been in touch with various sure. people, like Trotsky, for example, and then letters have turned up showing that they were, in fact, in touch. So if it was a coerced confession, they were coerced to tell lies. It doesn't really stack up.
In that book, mm-hmm. I also point out that there is some non-Soviet evidence that confirms some of these accusations. You know, for example, the accusations against Yuri Pyatnikov in the 1937, January 1937 trial. You know, there was this American engineer, John Littlepage, who, you know, during the Depression, when it was hard to get a job for engineers, went to the Soviet Union to work there as an expert. And he testifies that he knew for a fact that some of the charges against Pyatnikov were true. And I went to the trouble years ago, 45 years ago, of tracking down a gentleman at that time, quite elderly, who had been a student of Littlepage's in the 1930s. And I asked him, I said, you know, Littlepage wrote these articles and then this book saying that the charges in the 1937 trial against Pyatnikov were accurate. Was Littlepage any kind of a communist sympathizer? Is there any reason to think that he would try to defend, you know, the Soviet line? And this professor that I interviewed said, no, he was a real straight shooter, a real all-American Western guy. He had no interest at all in communism. He just went to the Soviet Union to get a job during the Depression. And so there is extra Soviet evidence from outside the Soviet Union that supports the genuineness of some of the charges in the Moscow trials.
All right. Now, for argument's sake, let's just take it as read that the men were guilty. Was it really necessary for Stalin to purge what he called the left deviation and then the right deviation? I read a book called Molotov Remembers, where it's a series of interviews. I'm sure you're familiar with it, with Molotov.
Sure.
That he gave, you know, after he was exiled to Mongolia or whatever. Molotov in that book seems to suggest that the Soviet Union would not have survived had they not carried out these measures, i.e. the purges. But my question is why? What was the specific threat posed by each faction, both ideologically and practically? I.e., if let's say they just found them guilty and said, well, you just go to jail now, or we're going to exile you to Mongolia like they did to Molotov. Why couldn't they have done that? Why was it necessary to, you know, to outright execute them, in your view?
Well, in the second Moscow trial, four of the defendants were, in fact, given prison terms, were not executed. In the third Moscow trial, how many? At least four or five were not given, were in fact imprisoned, not executed. So, you know, as I said, it's also very helpful to actually study the transcripts. Not everybody was executed. But let me just back up a little bit. Nobody in the Moscow trials, and basically nobody during the 1930s, in any of the trials that we, nobody was executed for anything other than a capital offense. So in the first Moscow trial, some of the defendants were directly involved in the assassination of Kirov. The other defendants on the first Moscow trial were Nazi spies, okay? They were in the pay of Germany. And so they were all executed. In the second Moscow trial, the Trotskyists, of course, by the time of the second Moscow trial, Trotskyism had been outlawed. Was no longer considered a tendency, a political tendency in the Bolshevik Party. Once the Moscow trials defendants, once the defendants of the first Moscow trial had been convicted of plotting to assassinate some of the Soviet leaders, including Stalin and some others, it was against the law to be a Trotskyist. But it wasn't a capital offense to be a Trotskyist, but it was illegal to be a Trotskyist. But if you read the transcript, you'll see the accusations against the major Trotskyist defenders in the Second Moscow Trial were that they were involved with not only with the Nazis, German spies, but they were involved in sabotage within the Soviet Union itself. And some of these acts of sabotage resulted in people being killed in train accidents or mining explosions. And there's a lot of evidence of that. So the people who were involved in those kinds of acts were executed. But some of the others who had, we're not quite sure exactly why, but evidently they had proven either to be more peripherally involved or had given evidence that the investigators did not already know about. Anyway, four of the defendants were not executed, were sentenced to prison terms. Karl Radek, who is probably the best known of these figures, clearly, after a certain point, cooperated with the prosecution and was given a sentence of 10 years. And so was Grigory Sokolnikov, likewise. Radek was a committed Trotskyist. Sokolnikov was an oppositionist, but he was not committed to any particular faction. Now, in the Third Moscow Trial, a number of the defendants were given prison sentences. And the reasons for that are given in the court's summing up. But if you read the transcripts, you can see that they were not involved in either not involved in capital crimes, the case of a defendant called Dr. Klimyov, or had given significant help to the prosecution in the case of Rakovsky, Christian Rakovsky, who was a major supporter of Trotskyism. But the other defendants were involved with conspiracies with the Nazis, with other oppositionists, with sabotage, and these are capital offenses. So the idea that Stalin purged people is incorrect. Let me just say a word about the term purge. The term purge is a translation of the Russian word chistka, which means a cleaning or a purge. And what a purge was that periodically during the 1950s, party members had to pass through a purge, which meant that they were investigated by the party, by their party groups, party collectives, to see if they had paid their dues, if they had done party work, if they had behaved properly, if they were good communists. And if they passed the purge, they were accepted. If they were not, they could be put on probationary status or even expelled. And that's what a purge was. So it is misinformation and very much confuses the understanding of this period to call the trials of the oppositionists who are involved in these conspiracies to call those purges. They were not purges. They were criminal trials with criminal penalties at stake.
And just while we're on this topic of the left and right deviation, we're jumping around a little bit, but I think it's worth asking this.
Sure.
Do you think it's fair to say that once Khrushchev embarked on elements of both left and right deviation, that he doomed the USSR? And I realize that we're kind of going a bit beyond your period here, but could Brezhnev have done anything to restore the USSR from revisionism after he basically ousted Khrushchev in the 60s?
Well, Brezhnev was one of the people who supported Khrushchev, and in 1964 was one of the people who was central in voting him out in the Central Committee meeting of October 1964. So Brezhnev was the Khrushchevite, and I don't think he was going to turn the party around. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, I think that when Khrushchev gave that secret speech in 56, clearly the party leadership was already behind him. And that implies that Stalin was politically isolated. Stalin, elements of that political isolation against within the party, elements of Stalin's political isolation within the party are evident even into the late 1930s. For example, Stalin initiated the drafting of a new Soviet constitution, which was finally published and passed by the the Soviet government and by the party, but by the Soviet government in 1936. It's often called the Stalin Constitution, and the Stalin Constitution calls for secret and competitive elections, universal secret competitive elections. It foresaw nominations of candidates for the government, for the Soviets, on various levels, who are not from the Communist Party. And Stalin argued strongly, Stalin and some of his supporters argued strongly for this, but it never happened. Okay. Stalin was unable to win the Central Committee. There's some evidence that he was unable to even win the Politburo, which was this much smaller leading group, to that position. Now, I'm not suggesting that, that would have been a good idea or a bad idea, but it was Stalin's idea, and he did not manage to win that in the party. Also, at the February-March 1937 meeting, Stalin said, he announced that there would be political classes. Stalin thought that the problems with the Soviet Communist Party was that people didn't understand Marxism-Leninism. Mm-hmm. The leaders, party leadership, did not understand Marxist theory, and they needed to do this. So Stalin announced that there were going to be schools. There were going to be classes in Moscow, and that party leaders on all levels would go in shifts, obviously, to Moscow to take these courses. And in the meanwhile, they needed to appoint some people to take their places while they were gone, to perform their party functions in their localities while they themselves were at these parties in Moscow. And he made a big point of this in his speech in March 1937. And these classes never took place. They never happened. So clearly, the party leaders on all levels did not want to do this. And we don't know exactly how that, exactly the details of how that played out, but the classes never took place. One could speculate that these party leaders did not want to abandon their leadership posts and turn them over to, other people. And go to Moscow for months at a time to study. Perhaps they thought that by the time they finished their studies, they wouldn't be needed anymore. They would lose those posts. And you could speculate that that was the same thing with the idea of elections. Stalin even said in a famous interview in 1935 with Roy Howard of the Scripps Howard newspaper chain, that it would be good for the Communist Party if some non-communist candidates who ran against communist candidates were elected to the Communist Party members were defeated, because that would be demonstration that they had not done good communist work. That would help them to improve their work. So Stalin did not get his own way and was met with opposition even as early as the mid-30s. But this is opposition from people who were not, you know, these are not Trotskyists or right-wing conspirators, much less, you know, Nazi and Japanese spies. These were people who had, who were loyal Stalinist Bolsheviks that who just did not agree with these policies that Stalin advocated. So Stalin didn't get his way. And this tendency clearly got stronger as time went on. So that by the time we get to the post-war period, the last few years of Stalin's life, I think it's clear that Stalin was isolated within the party. In October 1952 was the 19th Party Congress. Okay, this is the last Congress which took place when Stalin was still alive. And the theme of the 19th Party Congress was basically forward to communism, forward to the next stage towards building communism. The text that everyone referred to and read was Stalin's last book, Economic Problems of Socialism in the Soviet Union. It was referred to many times. It was it sort of marked this next stage of progress towards communism. The A Central Committee meeting was held right after the Congress, also in October 1952. Evidently, at Stalin's insistence, the structure of the party was, structure of the party leadership was reorganized. And to make a long story short, Stalin dies in March 1953, and within a very short period of time, Stalin's book basically disappears off the shelves. No one refers to it anymore. No one refers to the resolutions passed at the 19th Party Congress anymore. New party program and the changes in the leadership of the party were simply ignored. So clearly, initiatives that were supported by Stalin were not supported by the leadership, and Stalin, more demonstration that Stalin was politically isolated within the party. By the time he died, and evidently for quite a number of years before.
Yeah, no, I have to say, because one of the things I wanted to do is just read around myself, and another book I picked up, again, partly in preparation for this interview, was a book of letters from Stalin to Molotov. I thought, well, I'd have the other, you know, get it the other way. Sure. And this theme of Stalin kind of being a little bit isolated within the party, I think, comes through in some of those letters. There's one point where Molotov wants to take a holiday. He was like, I want to take 6 weeks off. Mm-hmm. And Stalin's like, you can't leave Moscow for 6 weeks. Because you can't leave Kaganovich, you know, Iron Laser, which in any mainstream history book is known as like Stalin's like trusted henchman, you know. You can't leave him in Moscow for, you know, on his own for 6 weeks. So it was clear that even people who you think, well, trusted Stalin circle, he clearly didn't trust him enough to leave him alone without Molotov for 6 weeks. There's another thing that struck me reading that, which is that Stalin is complaining about Rykov, okay, as early as the mid-20s, okay, and he's constantly writing letters saying, like, we're still going to leave this guy Rykov there? He's up to something.
Yeah.
And I was tracking it. It literally took him 10 years to get. I was like, what happened to Rykov? I thought, oh, yeah, they put him in charge of telecoms until 1936. I was like, well, this doesn't. I mean, what I'm saying is, this doesn't seem like the totalitarian dictator.
No.
You know, it wouldn't have taken like any, I don't know, Saddam Hussein or something wouldn't have taken him 10 years to work an enemy out of the party. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that struck me reading that. Anyway, in the interest of time, I want to get on to the one thing that everybody says. If you say the word Stalin to anybody, okay?
Yeah.
Like I mentioned, like I started reading these books on Stalin. My wife said to me, well, I said to my wife, one thing you know about Stalin. And her immediate response was, oh, well, he killed 30 million people. I mean, I've seen figures as high as 60 million people bandied about.
Sure.
I think Robert Conquest had it at 20 million people.
Yes.
So my question to you is, what is the real number and what embellishments have been made by mainstream historians over the years?
Okay, well, just one word about Stalin. Stalin was not a dictator. I've given you a couple of examples where he didn't get his own way, and there are others. When Stalin died, the American CIA actually issued a report, which has since been published. I mean, you can now read it, right? It's been declassified. And the CIA's conclusion was, well, don't expect any big changes. There's always been collective leadership in the Soviet Union, and there'll continue to be collective leadership. This business of Stalin being all powerful has never been true. So there's lots of evidence that Stalin was not a dictator. Nobody ever said that Hitler, for example, was certainly a dictator. That Hitler was stopped from doing what he wanted to do by the, you know, by the leadership of the Nazi Party or something like that. Hitler was a dictator. What he said goes. But that was not the case with Stalin. But you know, so Stalin is called a dictator because dictator is bad. We want to call Stalin bad things, so let's call him a dictator. Interestingly enough, in the second volume of his projected 3-volume biography of Stalin, Stephen Kotkin, who until recently was a full professor at Princeton but has now gone full-time to the Hoover Institution in Stanford, California, the Hoover Institution being the largest and best-funded anti-communist research center in the world, Stephen Kotkin starts off his book, Volume 2, by saying, you know, Stalin was a tyrant, and then later on saying, you know, words to that effect. He never actually calls Stalin a dictator. He calls him a tyrant. It's not quite clear what a tyrant is. But in any case, Stalin was not a dictator. That's part of the anti-Stalin paradigm. Okay, you can't say that. All right, it's not considered appropriate to say that. Okay, and you've asked another interesting question: is how many people did Stalin kill? And I think the answer is zero. Stalin didn't kill anybody. If you look at the periods of time or the incidents which those who say Stalin was a mass murderer cite, you'll see that that this charge melts away. Some years ago, I wrote a book called Blood Lies, which was a response to this very popular and very dishonest book by Yale historian Timothy Snyder. Wrote a book called Bloodlands, Stalin between Europe between Hitler and Stalin, where Snyder makes all kinds of outrageous accusations against Stalin. If you're going to come up with a figure, well, you can't come up with a figure like 20 million. Snyder, who's completely dishonest and also not a historian of the Soviet Union, so he knows very little about it, he's copying what other scholars have said, he comes up with some number like 8 or 10 million, but he doesn't really even justify that. And if you're going to come up with any kind of large number, you have to include, as Stalin's victims, the people who died during the 1932-1933 famine. So there's been very good scholarship on the 1932-1933 famine. And it's very clear that not only was Stalin not responsible for it, the Communist Party was not responsible for it. And once they figured out that they were facing a very widespread famine, they instituted all kinds of efforts to send aid to the famine-stricken areas of Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan to alleviate the famine. And there's excellent research on this by Professor Mark Tauger, T-A-U-G-E-R, of West Virginia University. Most, if not all, of his research is available here and there online, on the internet. It's wonderful stuff. I have summarized it in two chapters of my book, Blood Lies, and then again in the first chapter of my book, Stalin Waiting for the Truth, which is a critique of Stephen Kotkin's Volume 2. But Tauger has continued even since then to do yet more research. So you can't write down the people who died in the 1932-33 famine as victims of Stalin. Okay, that's just anti-communist propaganda. And specifically, it's propaganda that has its inception, German Nazi propaganda of the mid-1930s, and then gets picked up after World War II by the Ukrainian nationalist movement, the people who fought on the side of the Germans and then fled to the West, when Germany was losing the war, and became firmly ensconced in the secret services of England, Germany, and United States, and particularly Canada, and also in academia. And then when Ukraine became an independent country in the early 1990, I guess, streamed back to Ukraine and ensconced themselves in academia and in politics and so forth, to the point whereby the notion that there was a deliberate famine against Ukrainians instituted by Stalin and the communists in the 1930s, this is required in Ukrainian schools and universities. It's the myth of the Holodomor, which is how it has been christened by the Ukrainian nationalists, is simply taken as a given in right-wing historiography and also in Ukraine, and there's never been any evidence for it at all. So I would say that, but going on just to complete your answer your question, the people who were executed in the 1930s, during the 1930s, fall into two categories. One, there were those who were arrested, interrogated, convicted of conspiracy, espionage, sabotage, and so forth, and imprisoned or executed by the Soviet institutions. The second is this. In September 1936, a man named Nikolai Yezhov was appointed to be the head of the Commissariat of Internal Affairs, the NKVD, okay, which includes the political police. And Yezhov had his own conspiracy. And that conspiracy involved killing lots of loyal Soviet citizens who were completely innocent of anything, not even bothering to investigate. The Stalin leadership eventually figured out this was what was going on. Yezhov was removed from power. He and his followers were tried. We have lots of evidence against them. They were convicted and executed in 1939 and 1940. And I have a book on this, not a very long book, pretty easy to read, called Yezhov versus Stalin. But Yezhov was responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, virtually all of whom, almost all of whom, we don't really know the details, but almost all of whom must have been completely innocent. And Yezhov and his men agreed that that was the case. So they tried, of course. They also had a conspiracy to kill Stalin, but that never came off. So there was a large-scale massacre of, let us say, 680,000 people under Yezhov. Really a catastrophe. And the evidence for that has been forthcoming since the end of the Soviet Union. And, of course, more evidence comes out all the time. But even as early as 2010, I put many of Yezhov's confessions and the confessions of one or two of his right-hand men on my webpage. I published them, retyped them, put them on there in Russian original and then in English translation. And this material is out there. It's ignored by mainstream scholarship, but it's ignored in defense of the anti-Stalin paradigm, okay? It's convenient to blame Stalin for these illegal executions. So that's an important issue. If you want to demonize Stalin and therefore the communist movement, the Bolshevik Party, and so forth, if you want to do that, you need some major crimes, okay, to lay at Stalin's doorstep. And Khrushchev did that, of course, and Gorbachev did that, and that is what was picked up by the anti-communist scholars and researchers in the West, and continues to be published as though it were supported by evidence, but it's not.
Yeah, no, one of the things that interested me is that correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is Beria did a report on the activities of Yezhov.
Yeah,
In preparation for the trial where he was finally kind of executed, and my understanding is that Khrushchev relied on that report for the evidence that the NKVD used forced confessions. It was actually Beria's report that provides the evidence for the idea that the NKVD were known to use torture or kind of techniques that, would go against human rights or something like this. Is that true?
I reprint. I believe it's the document you're referring to that I reprint in my book, Yezhov versus Stalin. I believe the report is by Malenkov, Andreev, who was also a public loyal Stalinist, and Beria. Don't quote me on Beria. And they report that they have carried out an investigation on what went on, what Yezhov did while he was head of the NKVD, and conclude that he massacred a huge number of people. Executed a huge number of people without trial, without charge, without any evidence, and so forth. That document has been published, and I translated it and put it in my book. I don't believe it's translated anywhere else, but maybe it is, but I haven't seen it anywhere else. Certainly, I put it in my book 8 or 9 years ago now, Yezhov versus Stalin. Read about it there. It's Khrushchev. Okay, so we know about Khrushchev's attack on Stalin in 1956, 20th Party Congress. In 1961, there was the 22nd Party Congress. And the 22nd Party Congress, October 1961. There was even a, it was basically much of it devoted to various high-ranking party members, leading party members of the country, attacking Stalin. And it's all lies. Okay. Basically, lies. It's like one or two examples. After the 22nd Party Congress of late 1960, Khrushchev appoints a commission, which is called the Shvernik Commission, after an old Bolshevik named Shvernik, who was, had been a prominent second rank Bolshevik for many years. And their job was to investigate the defendants of the Moscow trials, the military defendants of the so-called Tukhachevsky affair, you know, who had been accused of inspiring Germans, Japanese, Trotsky, and so forth, and also to investigate, go into the archives and investigate and find the evidence that these people were innocent. And the Shvernik investigators were unable to do that. I mean, they went into the archives, all right. They wrote these very long reports. But they were unable to find the evidence that Khrushchev wanted them to find. And as a result, those reports were never published. They were not published until after the end of the Soviet Union. They were published in 1993 or 1994 for the first time, and then they published since. And Gorbachev, in 1995, of course, he and his men found those reports and used them dishonestly to show, you know, to try to gin up some evidence against the Stalin and others. But they were not able to, but those reports were not able to come up with kind of evidence that Khrushchev wanted. There's an interesting conference that takes place in late 1962. A conference of party historians. So you have to understand, during this period, talking about the Khrushchev period, every school and university had a specialist in party history, not just Soviet history, Russian history. Party history. And this was a conference of party historians, I think would be the most loyal. Okay. It was interesting papers given by leading Bolsheviks and some others at this party conference. But one of the papers, one of the talks that's given is by Pyotr Pospyelov, who was one of Khrushchev's right-hand men and who had drafted the first draft of what became Khrushchev's secret speech back in 1956. Pospyelov took questions and answers from the floor, and he was asked, and this is in the book, this is in the transcripts, one of these students, one of the party historians asked them, why don't they let us into the party archives? We're the party historians. And Pospyelov says, anything you need, you can find in the transcript of the 22nd Party Congress. And somebody else, another person, asks essentially the same question. And Pospyelov says, I've already answered that. So even the party historians, of course, they were a couple of thousand of them, right? All over the Soviet Union, were not allowed into the party archives. And now we know why, because the evidence in the party archives disproves all of these lies about Stalin and about the Stalin period. So we didn't have any of this evidence until after. Had the Soviet Union not come to an end somehow, we wouldn't have that evidence still.
So I have to come back to the famine in Ukraine. Sure. I picked up this very hard-to-find book called The Stalin Era by Anna Louise Strong from 1956, okay? I had to I had to find some Irish communist website, and it took weeks to arrive and things like this. But in this book, Anna Louise Strong claims that the famine in Ukraine in 1932, I mean, she was actually there. There are bizarre tales in there about there's this one passage where there's mass plowing of the fields, and they have this woman singing opera on the side of the field. I was like, this stuff is so bizarre, it can't be made up, you know. but anyway, in that book, she says that a little, like a story that doesn't really make its way into the version that you might see on TV. She claims that the kulaks who resisted collectivization and destroyed their tools and killed their livestock, you know, all their cows and pigs and so on, chickens. They just killed them all because they didn't want to give up their property to the collectivization effort. And she argues that this had caused a significant problem because, as you mentioned before, it was basically medieval kind of peasant technology they were using. Yeah. Stalin wanted to bring in modern machinery. Yeah. But then at this time where the Soviet Union needed a lot of food and they were already having problems producing that food and this famine came along, on top of it all, the kulaks basically destroyed the tools that were there and killed the livestock, which massively exacerbated the problem. Now, is that your understanding of what happened? And is there any evidence that you found to suggest that this is really what happened?
Okay, well, let me just repeat that I have not personally gone into the primary sources on the famine. Years ago, God, over 20 years ago now, I ran across the research, such as it was at that time, by Mark Tauger of West Virginia University. And I saw that he had gone into the primary sources. In fact, Mark Tauger devoted his professional life since graduate school in the late 1980s to studying Soviet agriculture and Russian agriculture more broadly, but particularly Soviet agriculture, and had always gone back to the primary sources. He's not a leftist at all. An ordinary, principled academic. And I got to know Mark over the years. I mean, became a big fan of his research. And his research is first rate, primary source research. And he has no political axe to grind. He's certainly not a leftist, a communist, pro-Stalin, any of that stuff. And Mark points out that there had been serious famines in Russia every 3 or 4 or 5 years, but on a regular basis, going back at least 1,000 years, back into the Middle East, deep into the Middle East. The geographical situation of Russia is not favorable to the kind of agriculture you get, let's say, in the American Midwest or even in the Canadian Midwest. Of course, Canada is more northerly than the United States. It's subject to droughts and floods, short summers, infestations of insects, plant disease, and so forth. And Mark, delineates some of these famines. Of course, there's been a lot of writing about them in the 19th century and the early 20th century. It was a huge problem for Russia. And there were 4 famines, serious famines, in the 1920s alone. 4 of them. So Mark's research points out that in the late 1920s, the Stalin leadership sent some agricultural experts to the United States to investigate some large-scale American Midwestern farms that they knew about. which were, of course, relying on the mechanization, okay? Heavily mechanized farms, relatively little labor, and very widespread. And then came back, and the Soviets set up some Soviets, what they called Soviet farms, a small number of experimental farms to try out these American, this American style of agriculture in Russia. They decided that that was a good model, and therefore decided to collectivize agriculture. And they decided to do this because every few years there was a devastating famine, and of course, who suffered? Well, everybody suffered except for the wealthy. Everybody suffered to some extent. But the poor peasants and the poor workers suffered the most. They were the ones who overwhelmingly died, okay, either directly of the famine or of diseases that result from malnutrition. So, and also it was clear that the Soviet Union could never become a modern nation, could never industrialize, and could never defend itself against the threats from Western imperialist powers. At that time, you know, the Soviets weren't clear who was going to attack them. It wasn't Nazi Germany yet. Hitler hadn't taken power yet, but France, England, Japan, Poland could attack and would attack. Stalin gave a speech in 1931 where he said, we've got 10 years to industrialize, either that or they will crush us. That's a pretty famous speech. So they instituted forced collectivization, okay? You didn't have a choice. You had to collectivize. Because to continue with the medieval form of agriculture was to doom not only the poor peasants and the poor workers, it was to doom the Soviet Union itself. It could never industrialize. It could never build a strong enough society, a big enough army to fight off the invasion that everybody was sure would come sooner or later from some direction or other. And, of course, it couldn't support the international communist movement either, which was centered, really, right, in Moscow. So they did this. Collectivization in that rapid form was basically complete by the beginning of 1932. So the famine of the fall of 32 into the late summer of 33 was not directly caused by collectivization. As you point out, the killing of livestock and particularly draft animals like oxen and horses would have been, certainly was a serious blow. The crash industrialization had begun, and there was an emphasis on building machinery for agriculture, tractors especially, okay? Because tractors can do an awful lot. They can, tractors can pull all kinds of farm implements, right? From plows to reapers and weeders and all kinds of stuff, right? But of course, and the Soviet Union bought tractors from Western countries, but by 1932, there was not sufficient tractors to replace all of the draft animals. Okay, and the industrialization of agriculture had not proceeded enough. And then, as Tauber points out in his research, there was a series of natural disasters. There were plant diseases. These are called rust and smut. You can look them up. I looked them up. They are real plant diseases, which particularly attack grain products. There was floods in some areas, drought in other areas, and actually a very well-documented infestation of mice, field mice. So the crop failure of 1932 the fall of 1932, was actually caused by natural causes. However, it was not obvious to the political leadership in Moscow that that was the cause until perhaps January. And initially, Stalin and the other leaders believed it was because of ineffective political organization and leadership by the local communist leadership. Okay, and there was lots of sending Kaganovich and others down there to browbeat the local communists. But it turned out that it was not, that was not the primary, the primary cause at all. The primary cause was these natural disasters. Once the Soviet Union, once the Soviet leadership realized this, around January 33, they started to provide extra rations and extra manpower into the areas most affected. And even before that, when they realized there were localized famines, didn't realize the extent of the famines, they sent people in to go around to the farms, to all the farms, particularly the better off farms, but really all the farms, and simply confiscate the grain in order to divide it up more in a more egalitarian fashion. I mean, the natural order would have been to let the farmers who had had, who had somehow or other managed to have a decent crop, go out there and sell their crop at a, you know, sell their grain at a very high price. And so what would be the result? The result would be the people in the cities don't grow crops, they don't grow grain, and the poor in the countryside would suffer the brunt of this. They would pay the price of this famine, and they would sicken and die disproportionately, as had been the case throughout Russian history. So the Soviets sent in teams to go around to the farms and sniff out what grain was available, what they could find that had been hoarded, that had been saved, and confiscated so it could be redistributed in a more egalitarian fashion. Now, of course, this caused a lot of resentment among the people whose grains had been confiscated. It's hard to know whether they could have done anything differently. Okay, that was their initial response, and then later on, starting in January 33, they sent teams of organizers into the countryside. They redistributed the grain to some extent, and as a result, the harvest in 1933 was successful. And it's important to note that the harvest in 1933 was brought in by a peasantry who had been weakened by the famine, many of whom had died as a result of the famine, but they were able to bring in a successful harvest, which once again suggests not man-made causes, but natural causes for the famine. At any rate, I recommend Mark Tauber's research on this. It's really first-rate stuff. Mark is writing a book. I hope it'll be more than one book on the Soviet agriculture. I was in touch with him, I don't know, sometime in the last couple of months. And he's one of these meticulous scholars who takes years to write his to write the great book, but I certainly hope he comes out with it as soon as possible. It'll be very, very
important. Now, I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent about this, and it's all right to say if you don't know, if you haven't come across it, but I've seen it suggested that the famine was exacerbated by Lysenko, that the plant diseases that you mentioned was caused by, like, you know, Stalinist Lysenkoism. Is that mentioned in any of the stuff that you've read, or is any truth to that?
Yeah, Mark Tauger has looked into Lysenko. he calls him crazy Lysenko. Lysenko had a success, according to Mark. I have not researched Lysenko. Want to know about Lysenko, to contact him. But I don't believe that Lysenko's experimentation with seed grain was a factor in the 1932-33 famine. It becomes significant a little later on when Lysenko opposes the agronomists, the agricultural experts who follow the Mendelian genetics, and Lysenko denounced Mendelian genetics, of course. Mm-hmm. We know that he was wrong to do so. But that's another issue. I don't believe, from my reading of the literature, that it had any direct impact, that it had any impact on the famine of 32-33.
Okay. So on the subject of industrialization, you know, most, even mainstream historians, even most kind of lay people in the street, they kind of do this thing where they say, well, yeah, he's a monster, he killed millions of people, but the USSR did achieve significant economic and industrial growth, yep. Huge increase in output during that period. I think it's 400% increase in industrial output. How do these historians reconcile the belief that so many millions of people died with this fact? How did Stalin achieve in 10 years what it took Britain almost 200 years to do? And I have to be honest, this is what got me down this line of inquiry, because I'm like, hold on a second. He's posting, you know, 6 to 10% GDP growth year on year with losing 20 million people, and they won World War II, and they got a man into space. I mean, like, some part of this is ringing the alarm bell. That doesn't make sense. So how did he actually do that? It does seem miraculous.
Well, there's a very good book by Robert Allen called From Farm to Factory. Allen is a British historian. He did not study, you know, agricultural collectivization or these other issues, so he kind of accepts them, but he writes about this economic miracle, if you want to call it that, of rapid successful rapid industrialization, and it's a pretty good book about that. I think that at this point in our discussion today, recognize that the story of Stalin killing 20 million people is nonsense. It didn't happen. The figure 20 million, by the way, I think primarily comes from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I believe it may originate in the, you know, the anti-communist emigres of you know, the 40s and 50s, perhaps, but I first encountered it in Solzhenitsyn. And Conquest just repeats all that stuff. Just as an aside, really got me started doing research on the Stalin era Soviet Union was Robert Conquest's book called The Great Terror, Stalin's Purge of the 30s. This book came out already when I was in graduate school in 1968 or 69, something like that. But I didn't have time to read it right then. But a couple of years later, after I got out of graduate school and started teaching, and my dissertation was well underway, I did sit down and read. And it's still his best-known book. And by that time, I had gone through graduate school to study medieval literature and medieval history. And I was fortunate to have professors who, of course, they had their own views, but they really stressed the need to use primary source evidence and not to pay any attention to scholars, no matter how famous, who did not support their conclusions with references to primary source evidence. Now, I took that for granted at the time. I've discovered since then that I was pretty fortunate to have professors who drummed that into us and who insisted upon it in our papers and dissertation and so forth. So I read Conquest's book. You're talking about sometime in the early 1970s. And of course, it's horrifying. I mean, you know, it's just one horror story about Stalin after another. But Conquest does have footnotes. And I recognized, or I thought I recognized, pretty much from the get-go, they didn't have any evidence. He just quoted other people who had written books, sometimes articles, but mainly books. You know, if Alexander Orlov said something, then that was Conquest's evidence, and so on. So, when my dissertation was pretty well in hand, and I didn't have a family yet, you know, had got children and so forth, I had time. For a year or more, I would catch the bus from northern New Jersey, where I live, to go to Manhattan to the New York Public Library, which has a really excellent Russian collection. At that time, they had a Russian research room just devoted to Russian research. I don't know if they have that anymore, but they certainly still have the materials. And what I did was I made up 3x5 cards of all of Conquest's footnotes. And then I went and checked his footnotes, checked to see if there was any evidence in any of these footnotes. And there were no evidence in any of these footnotes. Conquest would cite not only Khrushchev, but Khrushchev era books and articles. And they, of course, didn't have any kind of references to real evidence. He would cite any anti-communist source. He would cite any source that said anything that shed a bad light on Stalin or the Soviet Union during his time. But he had no evidence. Now, of course, the Soviet writers under Khrushchev and then later under Gorbachev didn't have any evidence either. They weren't allowed into the archives. But I did recognize that what Conquest said was just not supported by evidence. So why should you believe this? Then I went to read the reviews of Conquest's book in the scholarly journals. You know, because a book like that comes out by a famous scholar, it's going to get reviewed. None of those reviewers pointed out that Conquest didn't have any evidence. They all praised his, by one or two of them would say, well, you know, I don't know about this, I'm not sure about that. But they all praised his book. And I'm thinking, how can they praise his book when he doesn't have any evidence? So I decided I would, when time permitted, I would do a little research on my own. And I wrote an article, ultimately, took a long time. I wrote an article on the military purges. And the mainstream story then and now is that Marshal Tukhachevsky and the other high-ranking military officers tried and executed alongside him in 1937 were all framed. They were all innocent. Stalin killed them. Who knows why? Was he crazy? Was he jealous of them? Was he afraid of them? And I wrote an article pointing out that we don't have any evidence. We don't know. We can't say that Tukhachevsky was guilty or was innocent because we don't have the evidence. And that article was accepted by the reviewers of a Soviet Studies journal, Russian History. And then the publisher of that journal turned it down. And he turned it down. As he said, it makes Stalin look good. Well, of course, it didn't make Stalin look good. It just said that we don't have enough evidence to prove that Stalin framed these people or that he didn't frame them, that they were innocent or that were guilty. Mm-hmm. The reviewers of my article, ones who worked for who reviewed it for the journal, scholars, insisted that it be published. And finally, one of them, Arch Getty, who died recently, died in May, who became later on a major scholar in the field, told me that he threatened to resign from being one of the readers for this journal if they didn't publish my essay, because the essay had gone through all the expert vetting and gone through the process and needed to be published. So it was published. But it was published in the Journal of Russian History, which is still around. So it's a major Russian history journal. But when that issue came out in 1987 or 88, there was an introduction to the issue, a few pages at the beginning of the issue, the paragraph about every article, you know, sort of introduction to each article, except mine. No paragraph about mine. It was just omitted as though it wasn't there, although it was there. So that was my first introduction to what I have since come to call the anti-Stalin paradigm. I didn't know there was such a thing as an ideological requirement that you conclude that Stalin committed some crime. If he's been accused of a crime, you can't conclude that he might not have been guilty of that crime. I didn't know that there was this ideological imperative that I have called the anti-Stalin paradigm. But that was my first encounter.
Just a couple of things on Robert Conquest. I mean, one of the things that I concluded from reading your stuff and also just reading around some other books is that whatever Conquest doing was not, whatever he was doing was not history, because one of the things that stands out to me is that at one point, I think he like asks an emigre who'd been to the gulag, how many people have been in the gulag? Oh, probably about 5%. And then he takes that 5% and then estimates from that, literally just a guy telling an anecdote, oh, it's probably about 5% of the population, then he just makes an estimate from that and puts it straight in the book. I couldn't believe how shoddy that little one little bit of work from Conquest was. The other thing I'll mention about Conquest, little tangentially, I read a book a couple of years back called Who Paid the Piper? I don't know if you're familiar with it, by Francis Stoner Saunders. Kind of blew my mind, but basically it was showing how involved the CIA were with really quite obscure academic journals. For example, I was really surprised to learn that the historian Hugh Trevor Roper was on the CIA payroll. And at one point he wrote kind of a furious character assassination on the historian Arnold Toynbee. Cool. And I was like, why is the CIA involved in this? Like, this is such a weird thing. But anyway, one of the things that this book reveals is that there was this journal called Encounter, or The Encounter, which I sent it since has become kind of well known, and it was a kind of stronghold for what would become the neoconservatives, Irving Kristol and so on. But Robert Conquest was more or less the kind of court historian of this journal, The Encounter, and it's subsequently been suggested that a lot of the stuff that Robert Conquest did was probably at the behest, or at least on the tacit payroll of, you know, this was actually like official American state propaganda, which is why it got reviewed everywhere. Why everybody's heard of him, etc. You know, because he was essentially just, you know, doing the bidding, of the CIA. That's just something I kind of, you know, I'm kind of putting together pieces here, but in the interest of time, I should kind of try to wrap this up here. Okay. Why is Stalin, in your view, singled out as the monster in Soviet history? It kind of strikes me that, you know, the quote unquote evil it kind of seems like localized and personified and almost like just everything's put onto him. Mm-hmm. You've talked about the myth of the twin monsters, you know, the kind of Hannah Arendt idea of the two totalitarianisms. There's Hitler and then there's Stalin, and they're two sides of the same coin. Why do you think this happens? Why all this attention just on the figure of Stalin?
Well, I'm going to apologize for capitalism and imperialism. You have to make the alternatives look bad as possible, I guess. I guess it's as simple as that. It starts back by the time of the Russian Revolution, as I mentioned. And then you have Trotsky, and then you have Khrushchev, and it's all, you know, it's all too, I mean, you might say it's too good to be true, but I mean, it's all exactly what is necessary, what is useful to make the alternatives to capitalism and imperialism look bad. It'd make the communist movement look bad. And I think it's really as simple as that. And of course, after a certain point, the lies achieve a kind of life of their own, as you've mentioned. You know, people, you know, go around mentioning these tremendous figures, and they say that everybody was framed in the Moscow trials, and when you turn to the legitimated scholarship, all of which is shaped by this anti-Stalin paradigm, you know, you can't really criticize these falsehoods about Stalin or even point out that there's no evidence to support them. You turn to the scholarship, and the scholarship either supports it or at least does not dispute it. You know, what else is there? Not only most people, but really everybody is affected by this propaganda. It's part of the ground, as the saying goes, it's part of the groundwater. It's something that everybody accepts, and nobody really asks what the evidence is for it. So we've been in that world for a very long time now. When I write my books and articles and cite evidence, I am inevitably attacked because I'm often called a Stalinist. If Stalin is accused of some crime, you know, starving the Ukrainians in the famine, and you cite the evidence that says this can't be true, this is not true, then you must be a Stalinist. And therefore, your opinion can be, you're not trying to discover the truth, you're heavily biased, and therefore we can ignore what you have to say. So I get called a Stalinist all the time. It's kind of a litmus test. If somebody calls me a Stalinist, I know that there's something wrong with that person. Okay, that person is not really after the truth. If somebody says, oh, that's interesting, let's look into the evidence, let's talk about evidence, which is what you should be talking about, evidence, right? Then that's a different matter, and that's what we should be paying attention to. But if somebody says, well, Fern's a Stalinist, I think, in my experience, you could ignore anything they have to say. These people are not out for the truth. They're out to praise people who support the mainstream anti-Stalin view. And denigrate anybody who does not. I get called this by Trotskyists, of course, because the Trotsky cult is completely dependent on a demonized view of Stalin. But others too, who are, you know, who are just plain out anti-communists. So that's the situation.
So I mean, with all that said, I mean, another thing that got me down this line is that I've always heard these stories, you know, every once in a while we're told. But the thing is, in Russia, Stalin's still popular, right? We were always told this. And in fact, I saw it wasn't that long ago that they've now put a statue in Moscow subway station of Stalin, right? So do you see a time in the future, near, medium, long-term future, when the anti-Stalin paradigm might fall? And do you have any insight into why, despite all that has been said about him, and, you know, like you said, Gorbachev obviously grew up believing these things about him, why, despite it all, does he remain popular in Russia?
Well, okay. It was the Russians who made the revolution. So unlike any other country, except maybe China or Cuba, maybe certainly China, except perhaps China, certainly unlike all of Eastern Europe, the Russian Revolution has always been very popular within Russia, although much less so among the intelligentsia, who tend to be the people who have access to the media and to Western writers and so forth, but certainly among working people. That's number one. The Russians made the revolution, and so they are, it's an essential part of their history. Secondly, nationalism. Everybody knows that it was under Stalin that Russia industrialized, became a world power in a short period of time, and beat the Nazi Wehrmacht, the strongest, most successful army in the history of the world. And thirdly, there is still a powerful communist movement, or self-styled communist movement in Russia. I mean, the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, which is not a revolutionary party, but calls itself communist, openly avows the goals of communism, of socialism, is very anti-Khrushchev, anti-Gorbachev, of course, and very pro-Stalin. There's a widespread, not a universal by any means, but a widespread recognition that Gorbachev and Khrushchev greased the skids for the destruction of the Soviet Union, and therefore lied about Stalin, pretty broadly. I think there's a widespread feeling, not based on primary source research, but it's just a widespread feeling in Russia that that is the case. So Russia is a country, I think it's the only country, again, I'm not talking about Cuba or China, but leaving Cuba and China aside, Russia is the only country where even in academia, there is a space for, let's say, people who write the kind of stuff that I write, okay? It's not the mainstream view in academia. The mainstream view in academia is very critical of Stalin and very critical of the Soviet Union. But there is enough support still, enough popularity for Stalin and the goal of communism and the Soviet Union and the success of the Soviet Union industrializing and collectivizing in the war, so that there is a space. There are plenty of books published that could be described as pro-Stalin. Some of my books have been published in Russia, Russian translation. There are some academics who are associated with either the Communist Party of the Russian Federation or some of the other left-wing groups. And they can get published even in mainstream journals. And that is not true outside of Russia. In fact, the opposite is true in places like Poland and Hungary and Latvia, the Czech Republic. Spreading communist propaganda, which basically means saying anything positive about communism and anything positive about Stalin at all, is literally a crime. Literally. Mm-hmm. Subjects you to criminal prosecution, but not in Russia. So,
and, it'd be remiss of me not to ask, because a lot of people would. I mean, does Putin's government or Vladimir Putin, does he ever suppress any of this stuff, or does he encourage it, or does he just kind of turn a blind eye? Like, what is there any kind of official relationship?
Putin is Putin's a politician, but. Putin has given talks vigorously defending the policy of the Soviet Union in the 1930s to try to build an anti-Hitler coalition, which of course was rejected by Britain, France, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Romania, but particularly Britain and France, right? Stalin, and is in fact true that that the Soviet Union was the only country in Europe tried desperately to form an anti-Hitler coalition, and when that when the West refused, then had to sign the non-aggression pact with Germany to make sure that that they were not left alone to fight Hitler by themselves. So Putin has defended the role of Soviet diplomacy in the pre-war period, and he's right, he's accurate, and that view can be defended by, supported by all kinds of evidence. And he defends the role of the Soviet Union in World War II as being the main force for liberation in Eastern Europe, including, of course, Eastern Germany, but all of the Eastern European countries. And he defends the Soviet role in World War II and thereafter. He does not, to my knowledge, defend collectivization of agriculture. He's criticized that wrongly, in my view. So I don't think he is pro-Stalin. He also has a funny relationship with the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, which is a very large party and has numerous members in the Soviet Duma, in the parliament, has a lot of political power in various localities. And in fact, according to several experts, I'm not one of them, actually won the 1996 presidential election. There's evidence, evidently, that the 1996 presidential election in Russia was fraudulently given to Yeltsin, but that the Communist Party candidate actually won. So I think Putin is careful about this. By the way, the head of the I think it was military archive, but in any case, one of the high-ranking military officers a few years ago actually stated in an interview that the Marshal Tukhachevsky and company were guilty. There's good evidence that they were guilty. He could not have made that statement without clearing it with the government. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's this very ambiguous attitude towards Stalin and the achievements of the Stalin period. But of course, it's a capitalist country, right? I mean,
Well, this has been fascinating, Professor. For if people are interested to find your books, where can they find them? And where would you recommend people start? Because you've written quite a few of them. I started with Khrushchev Lied.
Sure.
What would you recommend?
Well, I start with Khrushchev Lied. It's the one that's been published in the most foreign languages, 14 or 15 by now. And the reason is that in a certain way, almost everything else that we've talked about and almost everything else that I've researched kind of flows from that. Once Khrushchev lied, you know, once you really see that he did that, not just that he said things that were not true, but he was deliberately falsifying, it makes you wonder what else about Soviet history is a lie. Makes you curious. You want to look into the Moscow trials and collectivization of agriculture. The death of Stalin and Mikhail Oils, or the Katyn massacre, or you know any one of the famine of 1932-33. It makes you wonder. Well, if the experts, if even Khrushchev was lying about this, what else are they lying about? How far does this falsification go? And that's really what I've been doing. I've been investigating allegations of crimes by Stalin for many years now. And if I ever find one, if I ever find a crime by Stalin that can be proven by primary source evidence, I will publish on it. And I'll say, hey, Stalin really did this. this criminal act, but I haven't found one so far. Where should they start? Khrushchev lied. All of my books are available on Amazon. You just go to Amazon and type in Grover Fur, and you see them all. I have a homepage. If you go to Google and type in Grover Fur homepage, it'll come right up. And you can download all of my articles. I have them there for download. You can see the titles of all of my books, which I said on Amazon. And you could also send me an email and they could inform your, although you can inform your viewers of my email, although frankly, if they just Googled Grover Fur, you know, homepage, you'll have my email there. And I welcome people to send me emails. And thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating. I won't take up any more of your time, but thank you very much for being so generous with your time and your knowledge. I'll let people make their own conclusions. Well, one person we didn't get into too much is this is his name Kropotkin. In the other video I did, one of the most common objections was just people saying, "Read Kropotkin. Oh, if you haven't mentioned Kropotkin, you haven't dealt with it." But then I was fascinated to learn that you've actually written a whole book-length rebuttal to Kropotkin.
Volume two of Kropotkin, K-O-T-K-I-N, Stephen Kropotkin.
Kropotkin, yeah.
Probably at Princeton, then at now at the Hoover Institution, a student of Stalin from his days as a graduate student, and also a student of a now deceased famous liberal anti-communist historian, Stephen Cohen. Kropotkin's first volume, which goes from Stalin's birth to 1929, is actually pretty interesting. It's anti-communist, but it has a lot of interesting stuff in it. Judging, by the standard of other works, it's less bad than a lot of them. But his second volume, which goes from 1929 to 1941, is basically falsehoods from beginning to end. So when I read that, and it's very long, it's 700 pages or 800 pages of text plus a couple of hundred pages of footnotes in tiny, tiny print. I think very few people read that book. I decided I had to go through it with a fine-tooth comb. I had to isolate all of the accusations he makes of crimes or misdeeds by Stalin, investigate the evidence, investigate what he read, investigate his footnotes, investigate the other evidence that he doesn't cite. And I wrote that book, Stalin Waiting for the Truth. His book is a monument, if you want, to the anti-Stalin paradigm, and my book is a refutation of his book and also of the anti-Stalin paradigm. And it shows to what desperate, dishonest lengths the anti-Stalinists will go.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, I could easily speak to you all night, but thank you so much for your time. I hope people will check out your work, and I hope a lot of people get to see this.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.